Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of Africa this Friday, November 14, 2024. A senior South Sudanese environmental official warns oil companies operating in South Sudan.
Before exploiting a resource, you have to conduct an environmental and social impact assessment. But what happened with the oil industry in Sudan by then? When Chevron left, then it went to Araki, then Talisman. We are in a war situation.
And a South Sudanese journalist says communities living in the country's oil-producing states are going through tough times.
They talked about the smell of the water. You know, the borehole water, it smells gasoline. And they said also it causes them diarrhea. Sometimes for 1 week, they can go with diarrhea if they didn't get any access to medical facilities.
We'll have this and more coming to you on South Sudan in Focus on this Friday, November 15, 2024. South Sudan's Undersecretary in the Ministry of Environment and Forestry, who is attending the COP29 meeting in Baku, says his country has commissioned independent firms to carry out studies on pollution caused by oil exploration in states in Upper Nile, in Unity State. Africano Battelle says oil companies ignoring the laws of South Sudan will be held accountable after the completion of their studies in oil fields located in Unity State.
We made sure that an audit has been done. We have asked for the other years when they were there under Sudan, but nothing has been done. But now they have started making sure that they operate using some high environmental standards. So whatever we are going to get will be made public. People will be held into account, and companies that have not been operating using high environmental standards will have to pay for that.
Talk to me about the South Sudan Petroleum Act. What does it say about companies that are coming to invest in the oil industry? I thought environment would be top on the list. Environment management would be top on the list. And if that is the case, why is it taking many years to hold these companies accountable?
First of all, if you've inherited a company or an operation, because what I know, before exploiting a resource, you have to conduct an environmental and social impact assessment. But what happened with the oil industry in Sudan by then? When Chevron left, then it went to Araki, then Talisman. We are in a war situation. Nobody in Sudan by then was thinking of environmental safeguards. What the Sudanese government were doing was simply make sure that they exploit this oil as fast as they can, develop whatever they want to do, because the oil is in the south. Okay? So, and those oil fields were actually treated as military barracks. You cannot go there. Okay? So all these years, even
today, the oil fields are treated also as a national security asset. You cannot go to the oil field.
No, but we in the military,
the national security are present there, and I will be arrested for filming and taking pictures of the damage or the damages.
Why do you want to go without taking permission?
It's a no-go zone area, Under Secretary Africano.
Our people used to go and visit those places. So even now, the firms that went to do the assessment were given clearance to go anywhere they wanted to go. So the reality is on the ground is not as you perceive, okay? It's not like when you're in the West, you can just go anywhere. There are processes that you need to do. Take the permission, get the permit, you are given security also going there. You also have to be protected from, like, given the right attire to wear and all that kind of stuff. So now we have the access to the place. Our people will be going there impromptu to make sure that operations will be done the right way. This audit is a game changer, and hopefully anybody who will be operating the oil fields in South Sudan will be putting environment first.
When will the results of the audit be made available to the public?
Very soon.
How soon is very soon?
You have 3 audits, 600 pages, and over 30 people going to review, going to go to the field to make sure that what is done there is corroborated, check all the lab results of all the testing that have been done, the sampling and all that kind of stuff. So this soon for us, we are trying to make sure that because the appetite is there and we don't want to boil things and we want to make sure that we do it right, soon is something that will take us at least 1, 2, or 3 months. So that will be a thing that I think is doable for us.
Thank you very much, Undersecretary Africano Batel. I will check back with you in 3 months to read the report, and we will have a discussion on that. Thank you very much.
When we get the reports and when we review them, they will be public documents. So everybody can research, everybody can look into it, and I think we are in the right track. So I will just try to caution the people on the ground that things are happening. The Minister of Environment will make sure that anybody who comes to the country and thinks that they will be able to pollute or destroy the environment will not be able to have free pass in this country. Thank you.
That's Africano Batel, Undersecretary in the Ministry of Environment and Forestry. He spoke to me via WhatsApp from Baku, Azerbaijan, on Thursday. A South Sudanese journalist who worked on BBC's Africa Eye latest documentary titled Poisoned Floods says what she witnessed in the oil fields is one of the massive environmental hazards in South Sudan. Maura Ajak says there are evidence of severe birth defects in newborns suspected to be allegedly caused by oil-polluted soil and water.
What I've seen there, I've seen families, they're living next to the oil wells. Those families migrated from southern part of Unity State.
Yes.
Towards the higher ground, which is the northern part of Unity State. So most of them, health-wise, I've seen like they have a dry skin, they don't look healthy. I've tried to interact with them because I went with the chief of Roriak. And he helped me also to talk to the communities after he understood that my assignment was about the flood. And he explained further about the families that are residing next to the oil wells. So we asked them why they are residing there. They said they don't have anywhere to go. I've asked them how they get the water, and they talked about getting the water from a stream. I thought maybe it's a seasonal stream. Unfortunately, it was water from oil exploration. So they showed me, and I asked them, how does it taste? And they said it tastes gasoline. Some water also is contaminated. And I've asked them also how they're managing. And they said there is nothing that they can afford also. And that's how they're staying with their kids.
Let's talk about the effects of the oil exploration on communities that you visited. Have you seen any pools of oil, or have you seen any side effects of the oil exploration that could be dangerous to lives of human beings and livestock in the area?
Based on what I found from interaction with the cattle keepers, most of them, they lost most of their herds, and they talked about birth defects happening with their animals also. Some have been born without limbs, like different cases, different scenarios. And some also, they said their cows usually used to go and drink from the oil well. It's like kind of a pool of water. the cows usually used to drink from there. And the next few days, some cows died. Based on the stories they told me, some cows died. And others, they said, like, remain with only 5 cows out of 1,000 cows. And also talking with the other community who don't have any animals to look after, they talked about the smell of the water. You know, the borehole water, it smells gasoline. And they said also it causes them diarrhea. Sometimes for 1 week, they can go with diarrhea if they didn't get any access to medical facilities.
What are doctors in the area telling you? Let's talk about Bantu. Bantu has a hospital. And have you spoken to any health officials there about this situation?
I've visited Bantu Hospital, the government hospital, and coincidentally, we found a case there. Interacting with the doctor, and he told us there are random cases being reported to the hospital. And usually they have cases coming in sometimes 2 or 3 in a month. And sometimes they keep records, and sometimes they see also cases over social media. As it's been shown in the documentary, the baby was on oxygen. And he told me that he's supporting the child just with the oxygen, just to see how far the child will live.
For the benefit of our listeners who have not watched the documentary, I'm saying for the benefits of our listeners who have not watched the documentary, you're talking about a baby who was born with defects. The doctor was explaining to you, is that correct?
Yeah, it's correct. The child's nose and mouth, it's open, and also the limbs, like the hands and the feet, it's not straight, and was supported with oxygen. That's what I've seen in the hospital with the doctor.
After your visit to the oil fields, you came back to Juba and had a sit-down with or a member of the Council of States. What is the government telling you, or what are lawmakers saying? Because this appears to be like a very serious environmental hazard that is ignored.
I've met with the first deputy speaker, Honorable Mary Ayen, for the Council of States, because she's been advocating also about those cases. She shares a lot of evidence about cases that happening also in Ruang, and she said that she's looking also forward about the issue of environmental audit, that it's overdue more than a year now. Basically, that's what we talked about. That's what she shared. Photos of children being having defects in growing, and yeah, she said that there are a lot of cases kind of growing. But I don't know how far now the government will collect the data, or how far they will share with us the other cases publicly, and especially the environmental audit.
Maura, I must say this must have been one of your toughest assignment in your career. How did that assignment impact on your life? I mean, you've seen people suffering, you've seen people affected by effects of the oil exploration. As a South Sudanese, talk to me from your deepest heart.
Because I've been covering, the security arrangements from the revitalized peace agreement, moving to the military sites, and then covering human rights and different stories, I never thought water will expose what's been hidden for years. And I was shocked through my first visit to Unity. It was 2021 during the floods, when a few community members start complaining about their cattle been dying randomly, and also seeing oil floating or on top of the water. To me, I had to process for years, honestly. I had videos about the floods and everything. And then seeing the cows floating over the flooded water, it wasn't normal to me. It wasn't normal. Yes, there are some natural disasters, but this one, it's not normal. It's not normal also to see humans, let's say that, walking dead, interacting with them, and seeing their health situation. It was quite tough.
That's Maura Ajak, a South Sudanese journalist who worked on BBC's Africa Eye latest documentary titled Poisoned Floods. She spoke with me from Juba earlier today on Friday, November 15, 2024. Stark differences over financing are emerging at the United Nations Climate Change Summit, also called COP29, now underway in Baku, Azerbaijan. This year, the key issue is how to fund poor countries to help them curb planet warming gases and to cope with the impacts of climate change. Darian Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
The World Health Organization is spearheading efforts at the UN Climate Summit, or COP29, to convince political leaders that as they negotiate toward lowering emissions of harmful gases, they're gambling with people's health. WHO Director of Public Health and Environment, Dr. Maria Nera, told a media event in Baku on Thursday, health should be the central argument for action to be taken to slow climate change.
Climate change is making us sick. Making us sick because it's affecting the way we are producing our food, how polluted the water we drink is, how polluted the air we breathe is, how the heat waves are now killing people around the world, and of course how it's affecting the mental health of our people. So it's making us sick.
Nera says putting the brakes on burning of fossil fuels like coal will unlock enormous health benefits.
For instance, we will make the quality of the air we breathe much better, and we can reduce, therefore, the 7 million premature deaths that are occurring every year due to exposure to air pollution. We can create a better, more sustainable food systems, and therefore reducing the mortality, reducing even 5 million deaths due to lack of access to healthy diets. And by the interventions we make at the urban level, where 70% of our population will be living in 20 years from now, by promoting a sustainable transport system, we will reduce all the diseases associated with this lack of active life and, of course, exposure to air pollution, lack of energy efficiency.
Abit Solomon leads a United Nations Children Fund initiative called Healthy Environments for Healthy Children. He says global warming consequences like extreme heat, drought, floods, storms, wildfires, and air pollution cause misery for children everywhere.
These climate-related hazards are linked to pregnancy complications, adverse birth outcomes, child malnutrition, killer infectious diseases like malaria, non-communicable diseases like asthma, impact on neurodevelopment and mental health, including developmental delays, cognitive dysfunction, and depression, injuries and effects on well-being, including learning loss, including violence, abuse, and exploitation. And I went through a litany of this because it was important to emphasize that we are seeing the impacts on children's health in almost every aspect of child health and well-being.
Solomon says climate change is causing children to suffer before they're even born.
Under conditions of extreme heat, a mother's body struggles to maintain a healthy temperature for the developing fetus. Excess heat is linked to babies being born prematurely and being born small and with birth defects. The odds of stillbirth and preterm birth increase by 5% for every 1 degree increase in temperature. A child eats and drinks and breathes more compared to their size as compared to an adult. As their bodies demand far more nutrients per kilo than adults, they become acutely vulnerable when nutritious food is scarce.
Solomon says nowhere are the effects of climate change on children more acute than in Africa. The youngest population in the world is also the sickest population, he says, with much of the illness caused by extreme weather. Unless drastic action is taken to help Africa adapt to transforming weather patterns and to build better health systems, says Solomon, the continent will never gain any advantage from being so young. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, death toll from Sudan's conflict could be higher than what is reported. Find out more after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. As the 2024 UN Climate Change Conference, known as COP29, continues this week in Baku, Azerbaijan, rights organizations Amnesty International is calling on wealthier nations to make substantial financial commitments towards supporting communities in sub-Saharan Africa suffering from diverse impact of climate change. Nchiko Wanchiko, Amnesty International researcher on climate justice in the Democratic Republic of Congo, tells my colleague Jackson Vunganyi, rich countries have so far pledged less than 700 million out of the 400 billion poor nations expect to counter climate crisis.
Indeed, displacement has been one of the greatest impacts of climate change events, as we have documented and observed on the continent. As you rightly put it across, like be it drought, cyclones, floods, these have been leading to millions of people to lose their homes and to embark on displacement as a result of the losses that they're experiencing. However, what has been somehow a bit sad has been the commitment of richer nations in terms of attending to the losses and damages caused by climate change and the consequences of these losses and damages, because once your house, your village is destroyed, you are somehow forced to embark into forced displacement. But now the issue that we've been really, really facing has been a commitment on the part of richer nations. For example, the continent needs billions of dollars to just adapt on the impact of climate change. Yet richer nations have so far committed less than $700 million to fight climate change, the needs that the continent have. So this COP is somehow really, really critical in the fight towards the fight against climate change, particularly the impact of climate change, such as displacement, because for the first time, countries around the globe are coming together to agree on what they are calling a new quantified goal on climate finance. So basically, this will have to be based on the needs that we are seeing on the continent.
Right.
Because the financial arrangement that we've been going by was the one of 209. It was not based on
damage.
Yeah, on any need assessment.
Yeah.
But for this particular time, we are going with this new financial arrangement that is currently being discussed in Azerbaijan. And the idea is to really, really make it grounded in the actual needs that we are seeing on the continent.
Right.
And the finance package that African countries are going after is actually in trillions of dollars. It's no longer billions. And this is understandable because climate change impacts have been increasing and worsening on the continent.
Like you said, the Fund for Loss and Damage has received far less funding than African countries need to address the climate crisis. You put the figure to what, $700 million, is that correct?
Yeah.
$700 million. That's way below the billions of dollars that have been committed. What kind of impact would adequate funding have on African communities that are facing severe climate-related hardships? What would the money do?
Yeah, so the money would really help affected communities, affected individuals, to address first the losses they are experiencing, be it in terms of their house being destroyed, their farms, their agricultural lands being destroyed, the cattle that they've been losing. It can also help these communities to adapt, of course, with the help of their countries, to the impact of climate change. And this can be, for example, countries such as Madagascar are arguing for putting in place a green belt around a part of the country that is experiencing severe drought, bringing water within that part of the country such that communities that live there can continue doing agriculture, which has been their primary means of survival, of subsistence.
That's Nchiko Wanchiko, Amnesty International researcher on climate justice in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He spoke with my colleague Jackson Vunganyi. Analysts say the conflict in Sudan has killed more people than what is being reported by aid groups. The United Nations estimates that 62,000 people were killed and millions displaced by the conflict that erupted in April 2023. Philip Alexio reports from Washington.
This is the gravesite of Khalid Sanori. He was a musician who died of hunger buried in his home's front yard in the Abdurman's Mulazmin neighborhood, a death that was announced on social media in July of last year. His friend, Muhammad Omar, took part in his burial.
My brother Khalid was sick, and the war started, and this is a frontline area. There were no hospitals or pharmacies where we could get medicine, not even markets to buy food, which is essential to one's health. These were all factors which had an impact until his body was frail and he got sick.
Assistant professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine Sudan Research Group, Maisoon Dehab, says across the country the main cause of death was disease and starvation.
In specific conflict severe settings like Al Jazeera, Khartoum, Kordofan, and Darfur, killings constituted the higher proportion of those deaths. So amongst the people who were killed, many more in those four areas were killed as opposed to have died of disease and starvation. What is of particular note is that in Kordofan and Darfur, the majority of people were killed, even when comparing to Al Jazeera and Khartoum.
Dahab says among the more than 61,000 deaths in Khartoum State, an estimated 26,000 people suffered violent deaths. That's a higher estimate than the one currently used by the United Nations for the entire country. Residents say hundreds of graves have popped up next to homes across Greater Khartoum since last year. With the return of the army to some neighborhoods, they've started relocating the bodies to Abdurman's main cemetery. There are as many as 50 burials a day there, according to undertaker Abdin Kadir. Still, Kadir says the bodies keep coming, and the warring sides have traded blame for the growing toll. The war erupted from a power struggle between the Sudanese Armed Forces and the RSF ahead of a planned transition to civilian rule. The RSF quickly took over most of the capital and has now spread into at least half the country, though the military regained control of some neighborhoods in Abdurman and Bahri in recent months. A UN fact-finding mission in September indicates both sides have committed abuses that might amount to war crimes, including attacking civilians. The war has also produced ethnically driven violence in the western Darfur region, blamed largely on the RSF. The RSF did not dispute the study's estimates, blaming the deaths in the capital on deliberate airstrikes on populated areas, in addition to artillery shelling and drone strikes. The new report highlighted the significant and likely growing toll taken by the war's indirect impacts, including hunger, disease, and the collapse of health care. Philip Alexio, VOA News.
That's all we prepared for you this Friday, November 15, 2024. When I leave you with Gis Majos and the song Shen Shen. For more on our programs, visit www.voaafrica.com. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Peter Hindley, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.